Welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Drexel.
And I'm Devin. And today on the pod, we are going to talk about how Trump is a very stable genius, obviously, duh.
Like a stable genius.
Like a stable genius. We're also going to talk about Camp David and some of the, you know, what was said there and some of the hot gossip about who was on the guest list and who wasn't. And then we have a very special new segment from our on hiatus host, Sarah.
Our esteemed colleague.
So it's going to be a really good show today. Let's first get into some quick listener feedback. I think overwhelmingly we got feedback that was just, you know, we're so happy you're back, which just warms my cold feminist heart.
I know. I loved all the comments. It was really great to, like, especially on Twitter.
Yeah.
And now that I'm in the Dickwads Facebook group, mm-hmm. and it was really good to see all the comments from folks.
Yeah, it's really nice. So Cheryl in particular, she tweeted, quote, "So happy to hear all your voices tonight. I've been really missing Hellbent." And hard same. I've also been missing Hellbent, so I'm really glad to be back. As I mentioned earlier, we have a new mini segment called Sarah's Shouty Corner.
Shouty.
She's going to record like a short little message on how she's doing and her thoughts on a particular story. So this week she's going to be talking about Oprah's speech at the Golden Globes last night.
Because if you're not talking about Oprah, you're not talking about anything.
Seriously. Like you said, unless you've been living under a rock and you don't check your Twitter hashtags,
right.
I feel like you should probably know what's going on. So she has a really great segment on that, which we'll get to after the news blocks.
So, Devin, are you a stable genius?
Obviously, yes. I love horses.
So, listen, last week, Donald Trump was at Camp David, and he talked a little bit about him being a stable genius, which nobody believed. But tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, yeah. So, like you said, Trump and his ragtag team of racists and wannabe Bono impersonators just hung out at Camp David. And stick a pin in that, because we're going to tell you who was deleted from that Facebook event later in the show. spoiler alert, it's Jeff Sessions. But basically they had this, you know, kind of summit. It was most of the Republican leadership in Congress and then basically every cabinet member except Jeff Sessions. I mean, there were a couple that weren't there, but
yeah, I even saw a photo with and Paul Ryan was there, but he was not in any photo that they released. Maybe that was intentional. Maybe he just like slid off to the side and he was like, I really don't want to be here. They dragged me here.
Yeah,
I got my tax cuts.
Yeah, right.
Don't make me do this.
I got my tax cuts. Can I just go home and hang out in Wisconsin? So Trump made some comments. He said that he's going to be very involved in the midterm elections. And, you know, Drexel, I'm really interested. We touched on this a little bit on our last show, but do you think that's a good thing for Republican candidates, getting Trump involved?
I think that it will be good for Republicans in Trump countries. Counties.
Mm-hmm.
I say Trump country because, I mean, that's basically what it is. In certain areas. And, I mean, he's still, if you're the president of the United States and you cannot be an effective person for your party, then you have no business leading the party.
Right.
And I think that Donald Trump is wildly popular with his base still. And so it will be good for certain people. I think had Luther Strange been the candidate in Alabama, Luther Strange would have won the Alabama race.
Right.
That would have been a no-brainer. And Donald Trump would have helped with that.
Right, right.
So I think that's something that people will have to remember is that even though his approval ratings in the job might be low, his approval ratings as I won't use the word inspiration, but I will use the word effective communicator to the voters that matter is something that we should remember that he is that person.
Right, right.
So,
although, you know, and I do wonder, though, because Roy Moore was the candidate, ostensibly because he was the more Trumpian of the candidates. He was more, you know, right-leaning, that sort of like incendiary rhetoric.
Right, but so was Ed Gillespie.
That's true.
And Ed Gillespie tried to use that same playbook, and we talked about that in the last episode. But, like, I don't know that... you know, we'll see what happens over the next few months, because if, you know, Donald Trump at Camp David talked about wanting to work in a bipartisan fashion on right. some of the bigger bills, you know, if he doesn't, he talked about the wall. If he doesn't get the wall, of course, he's not going to talk about DACA, which is a bipartisan issue. Right. And if that, if he doesn't get the wall, then he's not going to be working with Democrats on immigration, which is going to be something, another failed situation for him in his presidency. And at the same time, an infrastructure bill that his voters are desperately wanting, not because they want their roads fixed, but because it's a jobs bill.
Right.
And so if he doesn't get that because he can't work in a bipartisan way, then he won't be as effective for 2018 as he thinks he will be.
Right, right. Well, I think it's also interesting to note, you know, talking about this infrastructure bill, because when he talked about infrastructure when he was a candidate, that was one area where I think a lot of Democrats were like, okay, well, this is maybe one thing that we could all get behind. Like, everyone likes infrastructure. But then the specifics of his plan, it's less of an infrastructure bill and more of a tax cut for companies to bid on infrastructure projects.
Right. And it's not, and I don't think that it's a bad thing to be bringing in private companies right. to want to help cities build certain things out. And that's just an economic no-brainer right. when it comes to, you know, pushing out jobs and stuff like that. We know that the red tape in government, if you know, especially if you're in a big city, the idea of getting the government to pay, like, to hire people and all the red tape, like, that's a lot of work.
It's a lot.
And people don't necessarily get paid what they should be, and probably not even on time. So I think that it's not a bad thing to want to work with these companies,
right.
but it's got to be the right companies. You saw that in Puerto Rico.
Right.
The Secretary of the Interior hiring a company that they had
three employees or something?
They had three Twitter followers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they probably should have never
right.
been the company that to help rebuild that infrastructure. So I think it's about putting the right companies in place.
Right.
But Donald Trump he's about helping his friends out and
right.
not for the greater good of that. And Democrats just are not going to go along with that.
Well, right. Well, then I think to that point, too, I feel like at one point Trump or Trump's team tried to call the wall an infrastructure bill. Because it's building a wall.
Yeah. I mean, so are building with Legos.
That's also infrastructure.
That's infrastructure. I mean, we know that's what he's doing.
Yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah.
what he's doing in the White House. He's like, I'm infrastructuring. He's verbed infrastructure.
Somebody got a Lego right, set right. for Christmas. All right, my healthy seeking friends. I am not one of you, but 2018 is the year that I try. My first resolution? Cooking for myself more. I'm just kidding. It's getting my husband Alex to cook for us more. Either way, we've started using Sunbasket, the meal delivery company that makes it easy to say no to the drawer full of takeout menus. Today, you can get $35 off your first order when you go to sunbasket.com/hellbent. Sunbasket's menu reads like foodie porn. I'm talking ingredients like organic produce, responsibly raised meats, sustainably sourced fish, organic pasture-raised eggs, and organic non-GMO tofu. And it's all personalized. Sunbasket lets you mix and match from paleo, lean and clean, gluten-free, vegan, vegetarian, Mediterranean, and more. So there's definitely something for you. With Sunbasket, you have total flexibility. You can cancel anytime, skip any time, and choose any meal plan you want. And most importantly for me, each delicious, easy recipe is ready in about 30 minutes. Go to sunbasket.com/hellbent today to learn more and get $35 off your first order. That's sunbasket.com/hellbent for $35 off. sunbasket.com/hellbent. You know, and it's hard, you know, because that was something that Trump talked a lot about at Camp David is border security. And he's seeking $18 billion in funding from Congress for the first phase of this wall and other improvements on the U.S.-Mexico border, which right off the top, remember his line that Mexico would pay for the wall, that we would build it and
right.
they would pay for it? Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's not happening.
No.
And it's one of those things that I look at, and I will say this probably every time we talk about campaign issues, is that Democrats have an opportunity to use this in so many ads.
Yeah.
Republicans know how to use Democrats' words against them.
Right.
And it's time for Democrats to step up to the plate and say, well, taxpayers, the $18 billion, and they need to drill it into people's heads.
Right.
The $18 billion that Donald Trump wants is coming out of your pocket.
Right.
That could be used in other ways.
And with this new tax bill, it's coming out of the pocket of the, you know, low income and middle income brackets.
Right.
Like, that's right where the money's coming from.
And the other part of that is the Republicans, the border Republicans, are not asking for this.
Right.
And that's something else that Democrats need to exploit a little bit more.
Right. Right.
Which is, hey, or Texas border Republican, how do you feel about this?
Right.
Put them on the record
and
every time and
it.
Make them say it.
Yeah.
Because if they break with the president, if a majority of their border Republicans publicly break with the president, then it's just not going to happen.
Right. Well, you know, and the other thing about this wall that I think gets lost in this conversation sometimes is that it's not just this wall, but it's also just this racist, like, it's just racist.
Right.
And it's very much...
It's the ultimate metaphor
for racism. It's the ultimate metaphor for racism. And it's just disgusting. No, I really like that about the border Republicans. Because like you said, like, get them on the record. Make them say they don't want it.
And Republicans do that every election.
Every time.
Every time. They will exploit a Democratic weakness. They did that in 2016
right.
with Bernie and Hillary.
Right.
They did that in 2007 with Hillary and Obama.
Right.
They've done it every year, every election year. And it has cost Democrats dearly for that. And Democrats have got to step up.
Right.
And we haven't seen that yet.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. Trump also said that he was open to having a phone conversation with Kim Jong-un, which all I can say is, please God, no. I don't think that I could handle any more thinly veiled penis metaphors. Like, I don't want to read them. I don't want to hear about them. Like, please don't talk on the phone.
Right. And it's a little weird that he says that, like, if the president of the United States picks up the phone and calls a world leader, that world leader is going to answer the phone.
Right.
So why don't you just pick up the phone?
Right. Well, and also, what's also interesting and something that we haven't really touched on the show, because, you know, again, we have to make editorial choices, but there have been a lot of instances where Trump talks to world leaders or Trump does things that aren't in, like, the readouts, that aren't told to the American people in the same way that past administrations have done.
Right.
So, you know.
Well, they don't even keep a log of people coming to the White House.
Exactly.
So I can't imagine that they would keep a log of who he was talking to.
Right. So, like, when two world leaders have a conversation on the phone, it's not like a private conversation. Like, there's what's called a readout, where each government puts out, like, what they talked about and all these things. And normally they're a super boring two-page read on, like, you know, whatever they talked about. But I mean, it's getting to the point where the Trump administration's readouts are like four sentences.
Well, that's because they don't want Americans to know how embarrassing it is for
right.
Donald Trump to be talking to these world leaders.
Right. So, yeah, it was a very interesting meeting at Camp David. And Mitch McConnell is like, I'm one of the plastics now, and I'm going to talk about how great we all are.
Yeah, he's more of a Gretchen than anybody else.
Yes. Thank you.
He is.
He is.
But I don't know if that's an insult to Gretchen.
It is.
It is an insult to Gretchen.
That's so mean to Gretchen. You know, he was saying that, you know, this is the most consequential year I've ever been in Congress. He's very proud of all their legislative wins and judicial nominations of people who've never been inside of a courtroom. Apparently, he's really proud of that.
Going into 2018, they're really not going to be able to do much. I saw an article in the New York Times. I can't remember who it was. It was an opinion article. That said that Mitch McConnell needs to use the Reid rule on some of these appointments this year. And yeah, Republicans have the opportunity to do whatever they need to do.
Right.
Again, a situation that Democrats need to exploit a little bit more. I don't know that they, I mean, I guess on the other hand, Democrats don't want to challenge Republicans too much by calling them out by saying, what are you going to do?
Right.
And then they all rally again around each other and then they do that. So I can understand the political ramifications
right, like,
of calling them out.
Like, don't poke the sleeping dragon.
Exactly. Let it lie there until the elections. But you know, but on the other hand, you got to, if the president continues to say Democrats are obstructing, then that will be the last thing that voters remember when they go into the ballot.
Right. Right. It's true. You know, and this is just such a fucking episode of Black Mirror that we're living in right now. I mean, seriously, it's just terrifying. And, you know, and I do want to touch again on what we talked about on our last show, Drexel, about this sort of war with the media and Trump's this fake news awards that,
I know.
That was supposed to come out today that apparently was pushed back to Wednesday.
I tweeted out earlier a 4-year consideration for the political beat.
Yeah.
I just want Donald Trump to know that the political beat could be in consideration for that.
Please.
Hellbent could be in
absolutely.
Consideration for these.
Give me a list of categories. I'll submit to all of the applicable
I'm
ones.
Ready.
I'm ready.
I've got the speech ready.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and what is also interesting about this, and Vox had a really interesting piece about Trump, quote unquote, pushing back these awards, because, you know, after he tweeted postponing his made-up award ceremony, this had come kind of capped off a couple of days of very odd behavior, even for Trump. Like, you know, we mentioned at the top of the show, he called himself a stable genius on Twitter, you know, and it was over the series of a couple of tweets. He called himself a genius and he was like, he's very stable, because a big thesis of this Michael Wolff book is that Trump is just incompetent and not just incompetent in like a, you know, bumbles around kind of way, like who does not understand the underlying like workings of what he's doing. And it's just... You know, Axios got a copy of his private schedule, Trump's private schedule, and his schedule is shrinking. So
yeah, I want to start work at 11.
Seriously. Yeah. He's starting his official day around 11 a.m. Like, I don't start my official day at 11 a.m.
He's busy watching the Guerrilla Network.
Well, right? I mean, you know, and he's holding far fewer meetings, and he demands this quote unquote executive time, which apparently means TV and Twitter time alone in his residence.
Nice.
Which I'm like, are you a 19-year-old stoned college student? Like,
yes.
I mean, what? I don't know. And then on top of all that, so that was happening all week. And then Sunday he's like, well, we're pushing back the fake news awards.
And that's probably because I don't think that I believe in his head, he thinks it's going to be like this grandiose thing that's going to happen, like some award show from the White House press room. Like, what does that look like from the White House?
Right,
like that
right.
is something that like, I want to know.
Yeah.
Like, who's hosting?
Yeah.
What is everybody going to be wearing?
Is there
going to
be a red carpet?
Who are the presenters?
Right. Right.
And what do the awards look like? Like, I want to know all that.
Well, you know, all of these tweets and him calling himself a stable genius came because there was a lot of speculation about his mental health in the media. But I also don't think that talking about someone's mental health in the media and talking about Trump's, you know, any sort of health is not really useful to the conversation. Because on the one hand, you're like, do we have someone who is unfit for the presidency? And you can be unfit in a multitude of ways. But on the other hand, how can we tease that out without sinking to the level of insult?
Right. And this, you know, I know Donald Trump has tweeted about the mental stability of Barack Obama before. He's obviously talked significantly and extensively about the fitness of Hillary Clinton when she was a candidate. So, you know, this is a part of the conversation and the media eats it up. I mean, we saw what happened at the 9/11 memorial with Hillary Clinton and how the media just kind of gobbledygooped all that up.
Seriously.
And made it a thing. And so I don't think that it is, I think it's something to be have the ears perked up about.
Right.
But we've had presidents who've had polio. This is not uncommon for us to have a president who has some sort of issue that does not make them ill-equipped to be the leader of the free world.
That's actually a much more eloquent way of what I was trying to say, which is just because, I mean, maybe he has mental health issues, but that doesn't mean he's unfit.
Right.
And I think discussing it in those terms is ableist.
Especially as we go into Pyeongchang in a couple of weeks with the Special Olympics. Like, you have Olympians who can do things that shit I can barely, like, I was doing yoga the other day at work. We had yoga at work and I thought I was going to die. And so I'm like, But you've got people who can do it. Mm-hmm. And right. that is not stopping them from doing the job. And I think that we've got Democrats certainly cannot make this a narrative
right.
In conversation, because we are the inclusive party
right.
of people with disabilities who are able to do things.
Right.
You know, and so that's something that we have to be very careful of.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that kind of goes to what you're talking about with messaging. There's a way to message things and to sort of play the political game and use border Republicans' feelings about the wall against themselves without succumbing to this sort of ableist spiraling mess of, is the president mentally unfit? Like, you're asking the wrong question right. and it doesn't even matter.
Right.
Hi, Hellions. It's Sarah again. As many of you know, I have to take a break from doing the podcast regularly because I'm still dealing with post-concussion symptoms and a new one that appeared recently, which is sound sensitivity. So talking with Devin is difficult, especially for like an hour and a half or 2 hours, however long we end up recording. But doing a little quick, you know, 5-minute segment just myself is something that I think I can do. So we are going to have a new-ish segment while I'm on hiatus called Sarah's Shouty Corner, Sarah's Shouty Silo, maybe, if we wanted to be alliterative. Not really settled on a name. You can let us know which one you like better. But we figured I could just, you know, talk through one thing that was on my mind and, you know, get a reaction from y'all, and, you know, you can tell me what you think about each topic I talk about. So I figured since the Golden Globes were last night, I would talk through Oprah's speech and this Oprah 2020 talk that has been lighting up Twitter. So anyway, yeah, Oprah's speech was amazing. I feel like I can't even do it justice by describing it. Like, you just have to watch the whole, I think it's close to 10-minute speech. It was, wow, incredible. You know, I feel like I was almost too young to, like fully live through Oprah's peak on daytime TV and to like really be into it. And I feel like I missed out on a lot because so many women I've seen have just said, Oprah has literally changed my life. Like, I've seen that multiple times. So I feel like I'm finally getting a full sense of like the power of Oprah. And just, I mean, I've always known she was an incredible force, but to experience it and to feel it, I'm like, wow, I really get it. So because she gave such a great speech, of course, immediately following that, people on political Twitter were like, should she run for president? Should she not run for president? I saw a variety of opinions. And I have to say, for me personally, at least right now, I kind of have mixed feelings about it. And again, I would love to hear from y'all about your perspective because I am very open to having my mind change. But, you know, I think on the one hand, Oprah would certainly be an upgrade from this, you know, fucking trash occupant of the White House, to put it mildly. I mean, she would be an immense upgrade. So on the one hand, I'm like, I could see it. Why not? But on the other hand, I think my gut is still telling me that I want a president who has public service experience. And I think with Trump, in terms of public service experience, the bar has been lowered. You know, for me, it was no coincidence that the first female presidential nominee of a major party had to come to the table as one of the most experienced, if not the most experienced, candidate in U.S. history, certainly in modern U.S. history. And I think with Trump, the calculus has changed. I think with Trump, it's like, listen, if you have any public service experience at, you know, the state or the national level, then fucking go for it, because you are way more fucking qualified than this, you know, fucking bigot in chief. Again, I am open to having my mind change about Oprah. But I think my gut is telling me I still want a president who has at least some experience in government. So that's sort of where I stand. Now, I kind of want to talk through an exchange I actually had with Jon Favreau of Pod Save America last night, because we had a really interesting dialogue. And I thought there were some really interesting issues that were brought up. So he was sort of talking about how, you know, he was like, I don't have any idea if Oprah would be a good candidate or president. But, you know, he said, but dismissing her out of hand because Trump is a celebrity seems short-sighted, which, you know, I can agree with him. I mean, like, if Trump gets to be president, then who the fuck says we should say no to other people? Again, I think my gut tells me that ideally I'd like someone with government experience. But I think, you know, John makes a really good point there. And then he said, and no matter who the candidate is, I will always value ability to inspire and connect over governing experience and longevity in Washington. Always. I worked for Obama. And so this is where I felt like I needed to push back a little bit. So on the one hand, I completely understand where he's coming from. I mean, he was a speechwriter who worked for one of the most inspirational candidates we'll probably ever see in our lifetime. So I can understand how his experience and his perspective is shaped by that. For me, what I said, you know, I said, I understand where you're coming from, but I hope you realize that for women, the path to leadership positions is often through longevity, aka experience, and that the ability to inspire is often coded male. I think we saw that during the 2016 election. You know, that was a knock against Hillary Clinton that was used often. And, you know, I think from my perspective, you know, I was inspired by her candidacy. I know a lot of women were, not all women. There were plenty of women I saw who had legitimate critiques and did not feel gung-ho about her, or had complicated mixed feelings. And I completely understand where they're coming from too. And I think their viewpoints and opinions are completely valid. But, you know, Hillary Clinton did inspire a lot of people, but it wasn't really talked about. Like, there wasn't really any coverage of it during the primary or during the general, or, you know, certainly not after the election. I mean, if you ask the mainstream media, like, Hillary Clinton voters don't exist, even though 3 million more of us voted for her. But I saw that used a lot against, like, Hillary Clinton, for example. But I'm like, but she's inspired tons of people. But that doesn't get talked about, because the way we think about how people typically inspire, it's like rousing speeches. And again, like I said, that is typically, not always, but typically coded male. Jon Favreau, he pushed back a little bit, and he said, you know, I've been inspired by more women in politics than men since 2016. Maybe some people think it's coded for males, but that hasn't been my personal experience. And, you know, I said, I'm glad you're inspired by women. I am too. But I'm talking about persistent structural issues, not my or your own personal feelings. And then I linked to a tweet from Emily Nussbaum, in which she sort of highlights how, you know, this conundrum that women often face, like, we're either, she called it the Goldilocks rule, like, we're either eternally too cold, so experienced, canny, therefore ambitious and compromised, as we saw what's already happening with Kirsten Gillibrand. And then she says, or we're too hot. So random, lightweight, no cred. So I feel like that in general, what I'm trying to say, that in general, it's hard to achieve this, you know, sort of, it's hard to get to a point where a woman is like such a rabble rouser that she inspires in this sort of typical way. Like, that path is often not available to us. And Oprah might be an exception to the rule, but I think that's the point. She's an exception to the rule. You know, he ended up talking about how, you know, he thinks that women seem to be overcoming, you know, sort of structural problems. And I was kind of like, I don't think we've overcome structural problems yet. I mean, again, like I said, look what's happening to Kirsten Gillibrand. It feels like the same playbook is getting used against her as was Hillary Clinton. So anyway, I thought that was a really interesting exchange and dialogue, because again, I understand where he's coming from. He values inspiration very highly, and I think that's fine. For me, I'm like, I think we have to dig a little deeper and really get at the heart of what is considered inspiring and why that path, again, typically I don't think is available to women. I'm, you know, in order for us to achieve positions of power or leadership, we often have to come to the table with quote unquote longevity. We have to be the most qualified. And even then we might not get the job. So anyway, yeah, I wanted to talk about that because I would love to hear what y'all think. You can find that exchange on Twitter. But yeah, and I thought it's interesting, like this idea of transcending. You know, I thought Eve Ewing put it really well. She said, sidebar, I'm bemused by the vast underestimation of how much America hates Black women, and the presumption that Oprah transcends that. They turn on her fast, quick, and in a hurry. Then she said, remember what happened when Formation dropped. And I can see that happening. I mean, Oprah is not currently pursuing the presidency. So I think the same thing is happening in terms of, okay, she's not a threat to this executive power that has been almost exclusively held by white men. But I think if and when she would announce her run, if she should choose to do so, I think there's going to be a lot of sexism and racism that she would face. And I think this idea that even someone as phenomenal as Oprah could sort of quote unquote transcend that is a little bit short-sighted. So that's sort of where I'm at with the whole Oprah 2020 talk. Again, would love to hear what y'all think. You can tweet me at Sarah Lerner. You can post in the Facebook group. So those are my initial thoughts. Again, I'm open to having my mind changed about it, but that's sort of where I'm at.
Okay, Hellions, a new year, a new shit show coming our way. I can't help that there's filth in the White House, but I can help with the filth in your mouth. Quip is a new electric toothbrush company that is refreshing the way people brush their teeth. Quip is a sexy, cord-free electric toothbrush, and with Quip, you don't have to worry about getting new brush heads or toothpaste. They're delivered right to your door, on schedule, so you replace your brush on time. 75% of us don't refresh our bristles every 3 months. That feels low. I feel like it's closer to 90%. And I'm only barely an adult, and I maybe replace my toothbrush once a year if I remember, but I usually don't. And so with Quip, I feel like a full grown-up who replaces her toothbrush on a doctor-recommended schedule. And that's why you need Quip, to put necessary yet annoying aspects of your personal care on autopilot. Quip starts at just $25, and right now, when you go to getquip.com/hellbent, you get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/hellbent. Go to getquip.com/hellbent. Okay, Drexel, so everyone loves hearing from Sarah, obviously.
Love Sarah. I miss her.
I know, me too.
I haven't seen her in so long.
I miss her too.
I want to see her.
I know.
Sarah, come back.
I know. But I thought she made some really interesting points about Oprah's speech, which, you know, everyone, it was amazing.
It was amazing. I almost cried. Oh, yeah. But somebody asked me, because I was like, I nearly cried watching this. My friend was like, nearly? And I was like, well, I didn't want the Kat Von D to run across my face because I was wearing a layer of makeup on my face last night. And I did not need it to run down my face.
I just come
from an interview and I could not cry because it would have run and that would not have looked good.
So Drexel, what do you think to Sarah's point about Oprah running for president?
Well, I said to somebody, she would not be my first choice.
No.
She would not be my second choice. We've had, so like Al Franken was a great senator. We've had celebrities before. Ronald Reagan, for being, you know, he was a fine president. We might have disagreed on, obviously, but overall, fine, whatever. Right. So a celebrity is not out of the norm.
Right.
And we've elevated, Democrats have elevated candidates to celebrity status anyway.
It's true. You know? That's actually what I was just going to say. I mean, at this point in time, and there was actually something when Barack Obama ran for president first in 2008 and then again in 2012, is that he did become a celebrity.
Right.
Like in a very non-political celebrity kind of way, like a celebrity celebrity. You know, and he had top musicians and actors, and he hung out with high profile friends and like went out to like cool dinners, like you, and was in the paparazzi, like you would see a celebrity. So we have changed the sort of celebrity culture around politicians. Right.
Even Bernie Sanders, for the most part, was elevated into the celebrity status. I mean, even that stupid bird was elevated. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Became a celebrity.
Right.
You know, I don't know if he got paid for that. But, but you know, even that. Hillary Clinton, for the most part, became a celebrity in her own right. And rightfully so. And so I don't know. Obviously, we don't have that. I think that's where people right now don't see a front runner.
Right.
Because nobody is elevated to celebrity status.
Right.
Like nobody is that rock star Democrat that people are like, oh my goodness, everybody's looking at. You know, when Tim Kaine was nominated as vice president, he wasn't a rock star.
No.
And I think that turned people off. They were like, how is it possible that Tim Kaine is like, being who is this guy?
Right.
And people just could not understand.
Right.
That.
Right.
And so I don't think that Oprah is would be a terrible choice. I just think that we have to be very careful about elevating people without some sort of political background, or at least to understand politics a little bit to do that. I mean, obviously Oprah's run a business. She's very successful. And you know, I think somebody interviewed Stedman last night, and she said that, you know, he said that if the people want her, then she will consider it.
Right. you know, it's interesting. And, you know, Sarah brought up, Jon Favreau, you know, because he had said that just because Trump is president doesn't mean we should just discount all celebrities, you know, offhand.
Right.
That, you know, it can be, you know, but I actually don't have super mixed feelings about this. I would not love Oprah to be president. If she ran on the Democratic ticket, I would phone bank for that bitch all day, every day.
Right.
You know, like I am all in on whatever candidate Democrats put up. But I truly believe that there's a difference between a celebrity becoming a politician and a politician becoming a celebrity.
Yes.
I think, you know, to your point with Al Franken and Ronald Reagan, you know, obviously it has happened in the past, but that really is kind of the exception that proves the rule to me.
Right. I remember saying to myself, I mean, I've been watching a little bit after watching The Crown. I started watching a lot of Diana documentaries and stuff like that. And I remember thinking to myself, if Diana was alive today, she could have been prime minister.
Yeah.
Like she was that person, like the way that she kind of conducted herself post being a royal.
Right.
She was a humanitarian, and then she could have certainly been a politician. I remember Ashley Judd at one point was considering running for U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
So, you know, I always tell people this, and I said this today to somebody, which was celebrities are citizens.
Yeah,
they
absolutely
have the right to run for office just like everybody else, but that does not mean that they should be president of the United States.
Right. So my thing is, and I think Sarah also spoke very eloquently to the point that, you know, often inspiration and rousing is coded as male.
Yeah, I was a little jealous that she was, I was watching those tweets last night at 1 o'clock in the morning. and I was like, I want to talk to Jon Favreau.
I know, right? but, you know, typically coded male, which is absolutely a valid point. And I do think that, to Jon Favreau's point, that, you know, charismatic people are important, and especially in this day and age of messaging, like you said, where you have to message things so carefully, being charismatic and charming and being able to coherently, you know, present a message is so important. But I believe that we need a public servant first and a personality second.
Right.
And again, that's not to say that celebrities haven't made good politicians in the past or that they couldn't moving forward. I'm saying that there's a difference between being a member of Congress or a state senator or a, you know, whatever, and being the president of the United States.
Right.
I think you need a long history of public service, political experience. I don't care who you, I don't care if you're Oprah, you don't just walk into the White House and like, understand how it works. It's not a business.
Right.
The government's not a business.
And Barack Obama had to learn on the job.
Everyone has to learn on the job.
I will say the exception might be governors. Because okay. they're basically little mini presidents.
No, you're right. You're right. You're like the president of your state.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, for Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan,
right.
Jimmy Carter, they were all governors at one point. So they had that executive experience.
I actually completely agree with you. I think there's a reason why governors make a good pipeline to the presidency.
Right. And why John Kasich was – had John Kasich been the nominee against Hillary Clinton – I venture to say that that would have been a really tough race.
Right. Which is fine. But the fact of the matter is that I also think Trump is now this exception that proves the rule.
Right.
That, you know, you just because you are a very successful, stable, genius businessman
right.
does not mean you can be president.
Exactly.
I'm sorry. Our country is not a business. It's just not. We are right. not trying to turn a profit. We are not trying to – we are trying to make people's lives better. We are trying to support our citizens.
Right.
It just is at odds. And even if you're Oprah – love me some Oprah. And I just think that, you know, like I said, if she's on the ticket, I'm all in for Oprah.
Right.
But I think we need to start seriously looking at longtime politicians and you know, blend this sort of history of public service with personality, not the other way around.
Right. And I think that once we start getting, once we find that candidate, and we will. We'll be in good shape. I think right now people are desperate for somebody who can speak in the way that Oprah does,
yeah.
To the American people, and so plainly that they'll just latch on to anybody.
Well, yeah, it's also hard too because when you're a celebrity, obviously, you know, you have no private life. People love rooting around in your garbage. Like, I get all of that. But I think once you get to the political, like, sausage factory,
oh, yeah.
it's a whole other level.
Right. And I don't think Oprah, I mean, not that Oprah hasn't gone through her own set of scrutiny oh, absolutely. Over the past few years. I mean, even OWN, for the most part, wasn't as successful in the past few years as they thought it was going to
right.
be. So I think that, you know, there was a lot of scrutiny on what the future of OWN was going to be. You know, I think that going into 2020, we should kind of stick to the candidates that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
The Kirsten Gillibrands, the Kamala Harrises,
right.
the Cory Bookers,
right.
the, you know,
yeah.
the not senators from Vermont.
Okay, Drexel, so it is time for gratitude checks. I know we just talked about Oprah, and I have a spoiler alert into your gratitude check because I read it.
Nice.
So, Drexel, what are you grateful for today?
Well, obviously, I'm grateful for Mama O. You know, I every time I see Oprah, I'm like, dang, I wish she could be my auntie. Like, can we just be related?
Please.
I don't even need her money.
Right.
I just want to, you know, I follow her on Instagram and she's always cooking something. So I really just want like whatever's cooking in the Oprah garden.
Right.
It's coming out of the Oprah garden. Last night at the Golden Globe, she was awarded the Cecil B. DeMille Lifetime Achievement Award. It's really crazy. And she said it on the stage last night where she said that she was the first black woman to receive that award in the 75 year history.
Yeah.
Like there's been no one. Like I don't even know. Like I was having this conversation about Carmen Sandiego on my Facebook wall.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, because I was watching an interview with Selma Hayek, and I was like, oh, Carmen Sandiego. And I was, and so I posted on Facebook. I was like, what? Who would play Carmen Sandiego in a live action movie? And the comments were great, but it was like Penelope Cruz, Jennifer Lopez, and then it was like nobody could come up with a single fucking name,
right.
other than the people like that. And to Oprah's point, how has there not been an elevated black woman
right.
to that point?
Right.
Like, of course, we could be like, oh, Hattie McDaniel. You know, okay, she won the Oscar. That was about it in her lifetime
right.
of in Hollywood. Halle Berry, no. Like, who else is there? There's right. like nobody else.
Right.
So it was, you know, it was really incredible and refreshing to hear her up there giving a history lesson.
Yeah.
A Black history lesson as we go into February, referencing Recy Taylor, a Black woman who was abducted in 1944 and raped by six white men, left on the side of the road in Alabama only to have her life threatened. And then her story was saved and really investigated by Rosa Parks, which I did not know.
I don't think
that a lot of people knew that. So we were getting inspiration last night. We were getting a history lesson last night. We were getting a political message last night. Oprah was hitting all the points of a presidential candidate.
And not to like overuse the word, but I just gave this whole diatribe on why I don't think Oprah should be president, but she sounded damn presidential.
She did. I mean, it was 8 minutes of a good campaign opener.
Yeah.
It was really incredible and refreshing to hear her take this movement, the Time's Up movement, the Me Too movement, and Oprah-fy it.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm going to start using that. That should be in the thesaurus as a synonym for amplify.
Well, it's true.
So if you get Oprah-fied, I mean, yeah. And we saw that in the book club, like that montage last night of how many things that Oprah had her hands in. I looked over at Tim last night. I was like, shit. Like sometimes you just forget.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're like, okay. And she just used words that everybody understood. She Oprah-fied it and then made it, like I said earlier, just plain spoken enough to where everybody understood yeah. what Time's Up meant. Because right. there were a lot of people that I was reading on Facebook, that people just didn't understand why people were wearing black.
Right.
And they didn't understand this Time's Up movement. And if you put a face like Reese Witherspoon or somebody on these movements, people are like, but as soon as Oprah names it, then it becomes a thing.
Right.
And I think that was great for those movements. Obviously I'm not a woman, so I can't speak to those experiences that you or your listeners have had to endure throughout your lives. But as Oprah said, a new day is on the horizon.
Yes. That was the best Oprah impression I've heard in a long time.
I tweeted out last night, and like I said earlier, I think that if she ran for president, a new day will be her campaign slogan.
It's amazing. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Because she sounded damn presidential.
Yeah. And maybe that was the – maybe Oprah saying what she said last night was a message to Democrats – it's to say, take this and run with it as fast as you can, because now we've got the momentum and you need to do something about it. And yeah. because I cannot be your savior.
Right. Right.
And
exactly.
That's what people need to realize. Yeah. What about you, Devin?
Well, I was also grateful for just the whole Time's Up movement at the Golden Globes. I'm not a huge award show watcher. I never have been. I've never been interested, but I love fashion. I do. I love fashion. And it's one of those things where I get a lot, especially recently, more people know what I do and, listen to my show. And like a lot of my male friends, I'll have you know, are like, wait, but I thought you're a feminist. Why are you wearing makeup? Or like, why do you care so much about fashion? And I was like, first of all, fuck you. Second of all, fuck you. but what I really loved about the Time's Up movement at the Golden Globes last night was that they did something like wearing all black, and that fashion is inherently a political statement. And it doesn't have to be, but it can be. It's not just that celebrities were like, oh, we wear black, we're so into this, but like a lot of celebrities brought advocates as their plus ones. A lot of celebrities wore Time's Up buttons. A lot of celebrities donated to the legal fund that they're setting up. It's not just there was a lot of criticism that, oh, all they're doing is just wearing black and it's a publicity stunt. And it's like, well, no, that's part of it because publicity is important. But another part of it is like, that's not the singular act. That's just one part of it. Tarana Burke went with Michelle Williams. Ajahn Pooh went with Meryl Streep. And, a bunch of celebrities brought others as her plus ones. I thought it was really cute. Emma Stone brought Billie Jean King, who she played in the movie. She starred the Women's Tennis League. But no, and so I think I really like fashion as a political statement. And I wanted to read a little piece there. History.com had a fun little thing on the history of fashion. I mean, Did I spend Saturday night reading history.com? Yeah, I did. But, you know, I thought this was really interesting. So it was, quote, perhaps the most enduring use of fashion as a tool for political protest is the case of suffragette White. A member of the militant British suffragette group, the Women's Social and Political Union, asked protesters in 1908 to wear one of three symbolic colors at a suffragette rally: white for purity, purple for dignity, and green for hope. And just side note, it's worth noting that using white as a color of purity definitely is racist, and it was intended as racist at the time. Early suffragettes were very racist, very much not in favor of black people or black women getting the vote at all. It was all about white women. But the resulting sea of 30,000 women in white, purple, and green created enormous visual cohesion, and suffragettes began to make a practice of wearing long white skirts to their rallies because this visual impact was so useful in getting their message across. And I also think, you know, you can kind of, when you look at the women's movement back in, you know, last January, with the pussy hats and the pink, and in all of these pictures, you just see seas and seas of pink. And, you know, that is an arresting visual that I think really adds to the overall message of a political statement. And I think, you know, when you talk about award show, and you know, this is such like a big thing for actresses, and you know, people always ask like, who are you wearing or all of that, you know, to make a statement by wearing all black, and then by, when people ask you about it, then talking about this very important movement that you're representing, I think is enormously political and very effective.
Right.
So I loved that.
I wish last night, like, I love seeing all of the fashion last night. There were a lot of people in dark blue.
Yeah.
Instead of black, which, whatever. like, Zac Efron was in a, I mean, he looked damn good last night.
He did.
But he was in, like, a dark blue shirt, not with, you know, black, fine, whatever. But none of the men said anything last night.
I know. And I was...
Even after the Natalie Portman comment, Guillermo del Toro, who ended up winning Best Director last night, had an opportunity.
Oh, all he had to do was say it.
Yeah.
So this was also really frustrating. There was a piece, The Atlantic put out a piece this morning talking about this. And this is one of those moments where, like, don't read the comments, but do, because they're hilarious. Because all of these guys were like, well, when Harvey Weinstein thing came up and I said that I support women, everyone jumped down my throat for, you know, appropriating the moment and like, what are we supposed to do?
Right.
I'm like, you can't see me right now, but I'm making a very weird, disgusted face. Just like, I mean, it's one thing if you're like some random dude on Facebook, like posting whatever. These are powerful men in powerful positions. And all they had to do was say something.
Right. And I think that a lot of the, like, Seth Meyers last night definitely made it a point in his monologue to bring up certain things in the way that, in the best way possible, or in the way that he thought was appropriate last night. I'm sure he could have, if this was Ricky Gervais, he would have made a comment after the Natalie Portman comment and really run with that. You know, I'm not the biggest fan of Seth Meyers. I think the late show is a snooze fest, to be honest.
Yeah.
But I think that he has been super outspoken, Seth Meyers. He was on Pod Saves America last week, which I really appreciated his, interview. And, you know, he is gotten a lot more political. And I think that has a lot to, I think that once a lot of these people really think about their kids, that's going to be something that is super important. Even Dwayne Johnson last night, who brought his daughter up there last night, had an opportunity.
It was to so mention, easy.
I mean, she is like Mrs. Golden Globe now.
Yeah.
Ambassador, whatever. And he could have said something standing up there like, this is her moment, not only as an ambassador, but as a woman, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
That's all he had to say. Yeah. Support, blah, 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 blah. Zac Efron, you know, James Franco wasn't going to say anything because he has his own problems. You know, but there were so many other people out there that got up there last night that could have said something and would have made a statement. And I think a lot of women would have appreciated that.
Yeah.
Hey, Devin, it's Monday.
Yes.
You know what that means.
Dickwad.
Dickwad of the week.
Yes. I am really excited to talk about this because it made me so angry, and you're going to get some Devin Handy anger up here. So the dickwad this week is the Daily Beast, but more specifically, a particular dickwad named Ciro Scotti. Varsha, our researcher, on her notes for this episode, she was like, Ciro Scotti and his 76 Twitter followers can kiss my ass.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's good shit. That's good shit, yeah.
So Ciro Scotti wrote a trash op-ed claiming that Kirsten Gillibrand is too, quote, opportunistic to be a viable presidential candidate in 2020. And it read like something that would be run on Fox or the Wall Street Journal editorial board or possibly a garbage New York Times Bret Stephens piece. But no, it was on the goddamned Daily Beast. You got to be fucking kidding me. So I'm just going to run through a couple of the more asinine points, if you'll allow me. Quote, but in her relentless positioning for a possible presidential run in 2020, she was too quick on the trigger when she hit fellow Democrat Al Franken with a blast of buckshot and drove him to resign his Senate seat. Okay, first of all, you're a bad writer, so stop. And second of all, fuck you. Do you know who's to blame for Al Franken's resignation, Drexel?
Who that?
It's Al Franken and his groping Al Franken hands.
True.
It's that. Not Kirsten Gillibrand. Like, all she was doing was taking out the damn trash. And then he also said, quote, the larger question about Gillibrand, though, is whether she is too transparently opportunistic to be a viable candidate after her rejection of another New York politician criticize her for basing positions on supposedly canny calculations rather than on from the gut convictions. So, I mean, so you're trying to tell me that because, you know, she makes calculations and she thinks through points and, you know, she changes her opinions based on her constituents that makes her too opportunistic?
Yeah. I would be really interested to seeing Ciro's past articles about Hillary Clinton.
I would be so interested.
To see how the common thread is. Yeah. Pretty sure the common thread would be, well, that they're women.
Right.
Going to go ahead and assume that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did read that article, and I did see a lot of Facebook comments from a lot of people on that, which are all the same. you know, but I think that Ciro, I'd be interested to know if he supported Bernie Sanders in the primary too. that sounds very much like a Bernie bro article.
It does.
And so would not surprise me. So this article just did not surprise me.
Well, and you know, the thing I think we forget is that all politicians are opportunistic.
Right.
That's,
you cannot be, first of all, politicians are not only opportunists, they're also narcissists.
Oh, you have to be.
You have to be.
Nobody goes into politics because they think they're just meh.
Right.
They think they're the best fucking person on this planet.
And that they can save the world.
Exactly. That's why you do it. And, you know, I don't care. I mean, Barack Obama didn't run for president because he thought he sucked.
Right.
He ran for president because he thought he was great.
Right.
And he was. And I'm not saying that that's wrong. That's part of being a politician, is right. You have to be opportunistic. You have to know when to make the right move. You know, it's a little bit of like luck and math and magic. And then that's how you get there. But to single, and I'm not saying Kirsten Gillibrand is perfect, but to single her out like that is just the like misogynistic, you know, reiteration of all the garbage 2016 hot takes, you know, saying that women are unlikable when they're ambitious.
Right. It is equally as calculated on the parts of some of these op-ed writers to go after politicians, because essentially what they're trying to do is to knock out people before they even
get to the table.
And that is something that men try to do often when their agenda is being hijacked from the outside.
Right.
And I, again, like, that's why I bring up Bernie Sanders, because I'd be interested in seeing if Ciro is trying to knock out or attempting to knock out any competition that Senator Sanders might have in his bid for president.
Right. So. No, it's so true. And it's also just frustrating because, you know, I've seen this, you know, so Kirsten Gillibrand, there was a piece about Elizabeth Warren that was almost word for word the same piece written about Hillary Clinton in the New York Times the year before. And I haven't seen a piece about how Cory Booker is too opportunistic.
Yeah, he was flying around the country last fall for people all over the place. Yeah. Nobody said anything about I love Cory Booker, by the
way. I do too.
But like nobody said anything about that.
I have no problem with Cory Booker doing that. I have no problem with Cory Booker being openly opportunistic about running for president in 2020. I just think that it's not surprising that other Democratic candidates are doing the same thing.
Right.
Like, oh, really? You know, obviously it's Elizabeth Warren and Kirsten Gillibrand and Kamala Harris who are openly calculating bitches.
Right. And Claire McCaskill.
Oh, don't forget Claire McCaskill.
Actually, any woman Democratic senator.
Basically any of them.
Yeah. Except for Amy Klobuchar, because nobody really, like, I love Amy Klobuchar, but like somebody brought her name up as a presidential candidate the other day. And I was like, what? Like, nobody knows who Amy Klobuchar is. Like, she's like Tim Kaine.
She is like
Tim Kaine. She's the perfect vice presidential candidate in terms of governing.
Right, right, right.
Not in terms of inspiring.
No, but she's great.
Hey, Devin, so like we always say, there's a lot of things happening in 2018. Oh, what are some of the things that listeners can be doing this week?
Well, right now, it's so important to call your senator and members of Congress, Democrat or Republican, and tell them that we want a clean DREAM Act in a spending bill and the reauthorization of CHIP. People need to freak out about this more. People need to get mad about this, and your senators need to know that it is unacceptable that it has been months since CHIP lapsed. It's money for children. Right. I don't understand how it's politically viable to keep money from children.
Maybe they need to partner with Disney and use Chip as the spokesperson. That would get people interested.
Right. Oh, that would be so good.
Like a you know those Cigna commercials with like all the TV doctors?
Yes.
Chip from Beauty and the Beast can come out and do a whole thing about with Randy Chip. Rainbow about Chip. That would be great.
That would be perfect. Great. You should just be on the DNC messaging team.
I need to be. I hire me, Team Perez, Team Ellison, because I'm ready.
I'm ready. And then another thing, just continuing what we talked about last week, finding a way to get involved. There's so much coming up. We have a slate of women and men running for office that we're going to be interviewing in 2018, running up to the midterms. Get involved. Find out who's running in your area. Run for something.
Yeah.
You know, like get yourself out there and,
find your Democratic club.
Yes.
Start a Democratic club.
Yeah.
There are here in California, there are so many Democratic clubs. I'm one of the delegates to the state party. Find a way to get elected to your central committee, which oversees endorsements. Find a way, endorsements in that area. Find a way to become an elected delegate to your state party, because those are the things that will help drive the conversation. You're going to find a lot of Democrats that you agree with and a lot of Democrats that you disagree with, but at the end of the day, you're doing what is necessary to move the country forward.
Exactly. So that does it for us today, Hellions. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you back here on Thursday. Thank you.